Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
On the program today, we're talking about loss. How can caring adults help kids when a loved one dies? What does grief look like in a child? Kids These Days talks with people from Hospice of Anchorage's Forget-Me-Not Grief program this hour. We also speak to a local pastor about how faith can help kids through difficult times, and heartfelt and uplifting commentary from a woman who reflects on losing her mother when she was a teenager. That and more today on Kids These Days. Welcome to Kids These Days. Thank you for joining us today. This program is a weekly conversation about things that affect young people, families, and the community at large here in South Central Alaska. Kids These Days is an on-air community that's right here and right now, and that connection continues all the time online at kidsthesedays.org. You can join the conversation yourself by calling 888-583-7234. That's 888-KTD for Kids These Days Radio. And today I have with me a couple of lovely women in the studio, and we're talking about something that can sometimes be sad. Life begins with birth and it ends with death, and sometimes death can be a sad time. And dealing with the loss of a loved one can be difficult for anyone, and sometimes kids are the ones who are grieving, and it's important for the adults who love them to know how best to support them during this time. And our community has some resources for people who are in this very situation. And with me today in the studio are two women who can tell us more about them. Jane Barber works for Hospice of Anchorage. She's the program coordinator for the Forget Me Not Grief Program. Jane has a master's degree in counselor education and has worked with hospice for 7 years. Thanks so much for being with us today, Jane.
Thanks, Shan. It's good to be here.
And we also have Shirley Valak-Wilson, who is an advanced nurse practitioner with a master's of science in child and psychiatric mental health, adolescent psychiatric mental health. Shirley teaches at the School of Nursing at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and she helps train facilitators for youth grief programs at hospice. And she's also someone who's at the Student Health Center on campus at UAA. Thanks so much for being here, Shirley.
Pleasure.
It's great to have you ladies with us today, and I really appreciate it. So maybe we can start off by talking a little bit about the Forget Me Not program. It's a program with the Hospice of Anchorage, and it's specifically for young people, I believe. Jane, could you maybe tell us more about it?
Yeah, the Forget Me Not program, actually it's for families. It's for children, teens, and for the adults who love them. So the entire family is welcome. Yeah, we've been in existence now. We had our first facilitator training in fall of 2003, and we started groups in spring of 2004. And it's a peer support group model. It's based on actually a model of a program called the Dougie Center out of Portland, Oregon. They've been in existence, oh gosh, I think since the mid-80s, so they're about 25 years into it. And the model was so successful that they offered trainings out. And so our executive director took the training and set up Forget Me Not based on the bones of that program. So, yeah, there's a wonderful history with that program. So the peer support group model, it would be that the children, we have infant through 19, and then they're adults, and everyone, when they come to program night, meets in their age group, their developmental age group. So that's how it's set up.
Great. And then peer support. So describe to me how this might be different from some other kind of situation.
Yeah, peer support means that when the people come, they're going to meet in, like the children, the developmental age groups. We're broken down into, I'll see if I can get the list right here. We have infants, littles, kiddles, middles, young teens, and older teens. So when the children arrive, they're going to be put with boys and girls in their own developmental age group. So that would be infants. We usually have infants together with 3 to 5 year olds, and the next group is 6 to 8, and so on. So across a couple 2-3 year age group, they'll meet with boys and girls.
And so when they get together in these age groups where they're with people who are the same age as them, what kind of process is that for them? How is it different from just being in the schoolyard, for example?
Well, I think that's the beauty of the program, particularly in grief. It can be very isolating for everyone, children and adults. You can feel not normal. You know, you're going through this experience where time has stand still and the rest of life is still moving around you. And children don't like to be different. Sometimes they get singled out, or for many, they don't have anyone they can confide in, even a friend at school. It's awkward. So when they get into a grief situation, when they've lost someone, a special someone in their lives, they can come to Forget Me Not for as long as they want to. It's an open program. And we see it. I mean, it isn't even something they say, but you can see that as they come to their groups, here are kids in a like situation who get it. They're working with the thoughts and feelings and experiences that they are. So right, there's a bond, or there's a normalizing that happens for their process because they're with others who are doing the same thing.
And for, you know, a child who, say, a middle, mm-hmm. and being with a group of other similarly aged kids who get it, is there like a safety to that versus when they're out with, you know, a general population and there's kids who maybe haven't experienced that and they just don't understand what that kid might be feeling?
I think so. I think you've described it really well. I think the safety comes in the experiential knowing of what this feels like. Grief touches us on all levels. Children, too, you know, it's a physical, emotional, spiritual, mental. Every aspect of who we are is touched by this experience. Although I should say for kids, cognitively, we don't really fully grow our brains till I think the early 20s. I think Shirley, is that right, Shirley?
That's right, yep. Yeah.
And so the little ones, it tends to be in their bodies, and many times they'll process and they'll experience it through play or role playing. But yeah, they get with their same age group and they're with others who are working it through just like them. And so there is, yeah, there's like a bond or camaraderie to that.
So tell me some of the logistics. So you said that Forget Me Not is open to anyone for as long as they want to come. So how would a family find Forget Me Not and be able to attend?
Okay. Forget Me Not, it is. It's community-wide. Even though we're Hospice of Anchorage is one of our bereavement programs, it isn't just for hospice clients. It's open to the community at large, and there's no charge for the program to the families. The process is that they would contact me or hospice. I would visit with the adult typically and do an intake. We go through some contact information, but also information around the loss, the ages of the kids, their names, what they know, don't know, what they experienced, you know, were they part of the memorial service, and what concerns the adult might have around them now, like behavior concerns, and then also if they're also receiving counseling or other help at this time, or what help they've received. So we get just a good background, a working background on the family, and then we do an orientation with them to the program. Sometimes we hold those at hospice if I have several families. If I don't and I have a family that wants to start the program, I'll go do a home orientation with them. I'll go to their home. It takes about an hour, and we visit about grief, what it could look and feel like. Talk sometimes, if they want to, we can talk about their situation. I go through some of the safety guidelines we have in place for the groups. And I guess I should mention my favorite of all of them for any age group is the I-PASS rule, which means that anyone who comes doesn't need to talk. Sometimes they can't talk and they're not ready to talk, and they can simply come and be in the group and pass. They can participate by listening, feeling, and sharing without having to tell their story. So after orientation, then we'll visit. If there's any questions, we answer them. And then they're free to come to program night. And we meet twice a month on Thursday evenings now through year round. So,
wow. And where it happens, I think you told me previously that there's a partnership with Anchorage School District as a place for that to happen.
Yes. We've been in several. We don't have our own place for it. It takes a pretty good sized place because we like to have a large space. Sometimes the kids, I call them the Woogie Boogies, they need to get the Woogie Boogies out. They need to move. So we needed a large space. As the program has grown and we have larger groups of kids, we want to make sure that there's room for them to move and to play and to, you know, to do games. So I think it's been about 2 years ago, our executive director contacted Carol Coma and said, do you know of a space in town? You know, you're well-networked. Can you help us? And she said, we'll get you a school. She's been very supportive of the program. So we meet in the various classrooms and the multipurpose room in the gym, give us room to move. And, you know, it just works really nicely. But yes, we're very, very thankful to the Anchorage School District for their help.
I want to ask also about the initial contact that a family might have with Hospice of Anchorage and the Forget-Me-Not program. It sounds like it's a very personal contact with you. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you a question. In that position of someone who is maybe one of the first people to help a family through a grief situation, how is that for you to do that maybe day after day or week after week and month after month?
Well, for me, it's a privilege. I think working with people in grief, when they're in this very vulnerable experience that touches all parts of them, that to hold that space for them and to know that we can provide an opportunity where they can actually grow, heal, and have hope again. It's a privilege for me. I actually really enjoy what I do.
Do you ever get feedback from families about how being a part of the Forget-Me-Not Grief program might have affected them?
Absolutely. We get feedback from them sometimes after they've left the program, but I'll let Shirley weigh in on this too. We both have facilitated there for years. You can see it. I mean, you can see people come in, shut down, bereft, you know, nothing in their eyes or everything in their eyes, and see them connect with hope again. And one of the beauties of the program is that being open, we have people who have joined, families who have joined right after a death, perhaps. Sometimes families will join a year or so later when they've experienced a full season of all four seasons of the loss, and the loss is they've hit a roadblock. So sometimes they'll join then. But because they can stay as long as they need to, they get in groups, and you've got people that have been there a while and have moved a little further on the healing continuum. And so it gives them hope. You know, you're talking to people in all different places along that line. And I think that's a real benefit for them.
And let's get Shirley Valak-Wilson included in this conversation. Shirley, you are, among other things, you're a facilitator with the Forget-Me-Not Grief program. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what does that mean? What do you do?
Oh, goodness. I follow the lead. I follow the lead of the children. Basically, it's pretty wonderful because I never know what's going to happen. And what happens depends on the children that are present. Frequently, we get to be one-on-one, and that's magic. Because if you follow the lead of a child and they watch you mirror who they are and what they're doing, they just blossom. And they have so much to say in their play. And what they say and what they do, I may not understand. And the beauty of facilitating is that there's no interpreting, there's no teaching, there's really no right or wrong. It's merely being exquisitely present. So it's breathing, centering, and listening with every fiber of our bodies. All of our facilitators just really work at being present for that person so they can see themselves, and it's for that child, so the child can see him or herself in our behaviors in response to them. So there's nothing that they have to say that isn't important. Everything's important. And it's magic.
Can you speak a little bit to, you know, we talked about the groups of kids getting put into clusters of appropriate age for development and how they're dealing with a loss. So how might, you know, the littles, I think Jane mentioned that a little baby can really be experiencing grief very internally and not be able to express it with words, for example. So can you kind of give some general description to how, you know, those different groups of kids might actually deal with loss? A little bit more specific, if that's even possible.
It's difficult to be specific because every child is an individual. However, the younger the child, the more you're going to see it in behavior. It's the parent knows their children. And so what the child does is they're trying to make sense of what happened to them. They try to make sense of what's missing. They try to make sense of what their parent, their significant other, the person that takes care of them, their caregiver, is going through. And at the same time, they're having to negotiate the world as a child. So they have to play, they have to go to school, they have to do all these things. And children are miraculously in the present. So they can be in the present. And what we see is we'll see a child who is struggling with their grief. So they're not quite themselves. When you allow a child to grieve, then they can then again become their authentic self. And I think the question that you were asking is, what does it look like? They're going to appear the same and appear different. They're going to regress. So if you have an infant who has, smiled a lot and lots of eye contact, you just might see a little bit of despondency. You might see a little searching. I mean, there's an awful lot with the olfactory, the not being able to smell that person that's there. And the infant will become anxious. So you won't see the baby acting quite like the baby acted before. Maybe they won't tolerate their formula quite as well, or they won't breastfeed as well, or if their mother died and they don't have the breast at all and they had been breastfeeding, it's really difficult to imagine, because we're all adults and our brains are so different than the brains of the infant. And then the toddler, who sees the world as revolving around them, I mean, obviously they had to have caused the death somehow. And there's a lot of that with children who, it's the nature of the child to be self-centered, and that's an okay thing. That's where they should be. But it can be very, very painful because they think that somehow it was something they did. So being very aware of the kind of pain that they're struggling with can open a lot of doors, and we can let them know, no, it wasn't you. You know, there was nothing that you did. You know, that you are lovely, mm-hmm. and lovable.
And can you speak to how might a 16-year-old, and we're talking general terms, but when you get into children who are approaching adulthood, how might they show, how might their behavior change, or how might they be expressing, at least in the groups that you facilitate, what do you observe?
Mm-hmm. Oh, the teenager. that's between being a toddler and an adult. They go back and forth. Teenagers are very ambivalent. They're very philosophical. They're passionate. They're alive. They're awake. And everything's awakening. And sometimes grief is too much for them, and they need to put it aside. And they need to take care of the business of being a teenager. There's so many tasks that a teenager has to accomplish. And the death of a significant other is a real slap in the face. And it's crazy making. So for the adult of teenagers, it's a challenge, because teens need to be with their peers. But at the same time, they've got to have the guidance and that steadying place of their adult. So they're going to be, help me, I need you, get away, get away from me, I don't need you. Teenagers are a challenge. They are great fun, and they're wonderful support for one another. They're just so loving. Just and, love those teenagers.
And this might be a good place to get Jane back into the conversation as well. You mentioned that the Forget-Me-Not Grief program is about the family. This is Jane Barber, who is the program coordinator for the Forget-Me-Not Youth Program at the Hospice of Anchorage. So playing off of something that Shirley just said with, you know, the kids understanding that there's been a loss, but also understanding that their parents or other adults in their life are struggling. How is it that forget-me-not is a full family affair? How is it that the parents get involved? We've been talking about those developmental age groups for children, but what is the parent or the caring adult doing in these circumstances?
Well, the adults are a special group too. In fact, I've probably facilitated them more than the kids. What I noticed, or what I could say about the adults, is that they carry so much. They have, they know their kids are hurting, but they're hurting sometimes so much that it's hard to even be available. And that's sometimes what's kind of frightening in families. I think what we try to do as well in supporting them in the peer support, like they do share a lot of things like, wow, this came up in my family. How did someone else handle this? Or they can come in and just let down, like, this is what it's been like lately, or just sit and listen and not be alone with the crazy making process of grief. But what we try to do is also offer them some support. I mean, we have some parent education pieces, research-based, that show that if parents are the adult caregiver in the child's life, if they're doing well and they're grieving in a healthy way, the kids will be more resilient, the kids will do better, because they role model after the parents. So we encourage self-care for the parents, because sometimes they don't feel like they should, or they can give that to themselves, to take care of themselves. And we help them understand how grief looks different in their kids from them, because sometimes they don't know. You know, they, as Shirley was saying, we're doing it at our own age and level, and we sometimes forget what the experience of the child is like. So we help them sometimes understanding that and support them as they try to understand. And then we actually encourage some family, what we call family fun times. There's been a loss in the family, but there's a family that's left. And so we have some words of encouragement and some examples of things they can do on a regular basis to rebuild the family and to reconnect. So, yeah, the adults have lots going on. In addition to the grief, a lot of times if it's been a spousal loss, there's financial challenges. There's, you know, they've got the day-to-day challenges on top of all of the feelings and being thrown into maybe the position of being the only parent now for the kiddos. So, yeah, they've got a big challenge.
Tell me a little bit more about what self-care for that caring adult means, and how would someone who wants to get that go about getting it?
Well, self-care, and I think it's important to bring it up with adults, because sometimes there's a guilt in death, and it's hard to even start with yourself. But the self-care are those little things that an individual knows that they can do that, you know, if you're taking care of the senses, even like a hot cup of tea, a bath, a walk in the woods, what gives you, what nurtures you, what helps you even in that moment to self-soothe, to feel a little more connected and grounded. And so those are some of the self-care things. The next level might be you're grieving and the kids around you are grieving. Do you have a friend who can come by and watch the kids so you can have some time for yourself? Just those little things that they can do to help themselves regain some strength and balance. Mm-hmm. And so that they're not only there more for themselves, but also for the kids and the family.
Well, I'd like to remind listeners that this is Kids These Days. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy, and I am in the studio today with Jane Barber. She's the program coordinator for Hospice of Anchorage's Forget-Me-Not Grief Program, which is a program for families. And also with Shirley Valick-Wilson, who is, among many things, a professor with the UAA School of Nursing. I want to transition just a little bit, and Shirley, you have some experience with play therapy. Can you tell me a little bit about what play therapy is about, what it means?
Well, play therapy is actually a theoretical base for treating children. At Forget-Me-Not, we do not do play therapy. What we do is we facilitate play. And so we're not really thinking about the theoretical base. We're not thinking of Carl Rogers or Virginia Axline or any of those folks.
I imagine these are people who've done research about this or something.
Yeah, these are the early folks in play therapy. What we do is we'll use a lot of the play therapy techniques. And basically that's following the lead of the child. So if the child says, You are a dragon, and I am a dragon slayer, and you chase me, we would say, okay, what does a dragon look like chasing you? Well, snarl and run and growl and spit fire at me. So I will run and snarl and growl and spit fire. And the child will run and usually scream and say various things. Then I'll reflect back. You are screaming and running because there's a snarling, fire-spitting dragon chasing you. So you get caught up in their play and you do it the way they want you to do it. And you keep checking back. Am I doing it right? Am I being the dragon you need? I won't use those words, but that's the intent. So I want to do exactly what the child needs me to do to facilitate their play.
And this might seem like the obvious question, but what does that give them? If you're available and trained to do that, how does that help?
It validates them. And it's going back to the brain of the child. So the child feels understood. It's just like if you were to go to talk therapy or you have a friend that really knows how to listen. When you feel understood, then you feel real and you're free. You're free to do whatever you need to do in your life. And children play. And play is so essential to childhood. It's essential to adulthood too, but it's different. For children, it's this magical thing. It's back to, it is so real what they're doing when they're doing it. It's a real dragon, and they really are a dragon slayer. And you have to remember that children have no power. So often their play is something where they can get some power. And then they can put themselves in a vulnerable position and get themselves out of it. So they can be caught by the witch or the dragon or whatever archetypal figure that they pull out of the air, and then they can get away. Children will often say, okay, catch me, catch me, catch me. And then you come up and you catch and you go, okay, how should I catch you? Well, put your arms around me. Okay, I'm out. And then they just bust out. And then they'll turn around and they'll make you dead. They'll shoot you. I mean, even if they've never heard of guns, they shoot you. They stab you. They'll turn into a shark and they'll eat you. And you never know when this is going to happen. But they do it. And when you respond in like, when you do what they need you to do, it opens them up, it frees them.
And does play therapy, does it work? I think from your examples, it sounds like you're talking about doing play therapy with, or playing in a therapeutic way with younger kids. Is it ever something you would employ with older kids, like middle schoolers or high schoolers?
Oh, absolutely.
How do you do it if it's with a teen?
There's elements of play. Well, with teenagers, you would play with words.
Oh.
So you do word play. You do music play. You do poetry. You do things in metaphor. Play is sort of a metaphorical kind of thing. Although children are very concrete, their play is metaphor. But we don't interpret the metaphor. So the older children, when they can start putting language to things, They can develop a dream world or develop how maybe things could look. They can experiment with, oh gosh, what would it have been like if my brother were still alive? You know, what would that have looked like? And what does it look like now? And what can I do to make it okay for me? And that's what we want for our children.
Thanks, Shirley. That's Shirley Velick-Wilson, describing play therapy as it relates to helping young people deal with loss. That's what we're talking about today on Kids These Days. We're talking about bereavement. We also have Jane Barber in the studio with us as well, and she is with Hospice of Anchorage. It's time for a short break. We'll be back with more from these two lovely ladies. And later in the program, we'll hear from a Lutheran pastor about how faith can help young people cope with loss. That's all coming up on Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and we'll be back in a minute. Next time on Kids These Days, we're talking about emergency preparedness and the big bad world. Is your family ready for the next big earthquake? Do you have a fire escape plan in place in your home? We'll learn about Ready Alaska and its family and community resources. And we'll explore ways you can help kids deal with bad news. It's hard to shelter kids entirely from global catastrophes like Haiti or scenes from war zones. So how best to deal with that as caretakers? All that and more next time on Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Join me Tuesday at 2 and again at 7 right here on KSKA. You're listening to Kids These Days. Today we're in the studio with Shirley Valick-Wilson, an advanced nurse practitioner who works with the UAA School of Nursing, and Jane Barber from Hospice of Anchorage. And I'm Shanna Sheehy. We're learning about how to get support for you and for the kids you care for when someone who is loved passes away. This program and more related information can be found online as well at kidsthesedays.org. Now, let me get back to our conversation with Shirley Valick-Wilson and Jane Barber. And I'm wondering, could either or both of you talk a little bit about the stages of grief and whether or not kids are prone to going through those in the same way that adults are?
Well,
this
actually,
is Shirley. Shirley's going to take that one
no
on.
There stages. Are no, 1, 2, 3, Jane.
There are no stages of grief.
Grieving is a very individual process. There are tasks of grief. And so I guess, gosh, some experts identify about 6 or 7, even 8. But we like to keep it simple. The first task is to recognize that the person has died. Initially, people are numb, and they really can't get it. They can't get it into their head that that person is dead and they're not coming back. So that's one of the tasks, is to recognize that they're not going to come back. The next task is to actually experience the grieving process. And because it's so painful, people will try to avoid it. But you need to feel the grief, and you need to feel it in your brain, cognitively, intellectually, emotionally, physically, the physical feelings. People feel really sick often, and lots of aches and pains and physical things will come up for people. And spiritually, how could there be a God if this person is dead? How could that be? The big word that comes out of people's mouths is no, no, can't be, no. And then I don't like the word move on, but to begin to live and love in a new normal and to recognize that you're grieving because you cared deeply. You didn't always necessarily love the person, but they were meaningful to you. They were very important for you. So that loss it's devastating. And for children, it's devastating. So it's the tasks, having to actually experience that grieving process. Jane, what's your thought?
And have you, thank you for explaining the idea of it being tasks instead of stages. Do you think the description is great, and I'm wondering, is that universal for kids, young adults and adults alike, those things? Or are they really different for younger people?
They're universal. They're just done in different ways.
Okay.
And then you have to remember that it will be revisited. So at every developmental level for the child, they're going to revisit that loss, that death, that absence in their life. It's going to look different.
And Jane Barber?
I just wanted to say, you know, you heard us say there are no stages of grief. And you hear stages of grief, so I just wanted to clarify that point a little bit. I believe that started, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did much, much, much to bring bereavement and dying into the focus of the world. And her stages of grief had more to do with the dying process, the mm-hmm. anger, the denial, all of that. So, and people put them on bereavement or grief, but they're actually the acceptance of the dying process.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah. I see. Okay. Thank you.
And it's not to say that you're not going to be angry because you are, and that you're not going to deny because you are, and that you're not going to, what does it say? I'll be good if, what is that, bargaining? And how does it go?
Yeah.
Anger. Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's acceptance.
Yeah. And then acceptance. And that acceptance piece in grieving, it's very individual because there's a transformation that comes about. And people grow through the grieving process. And it's not something we're going to tell anyone who's freshly bereaved, because you just can't say, hey, things are going to get better. Because I'm sorry, that's not where that person is. That isn't what they need to hear. They need to be able to express themselves. And they need to express themselves in an accepting, non-judgmental arena.
Jane?
I just wanted to add on to that I think at the Forget-Me-Not program, I always tell families in orientation that I feel on program nights when they come through the door that there's a question hanging in the air. What do you need tonight? And that's where we operate from. We want to give them what they need in that space to be safe in their grief process, no matter if they're 3 years old or 53 or 73. So,
and as we're talking about process, unless it's too personal, and please say so, was it personal experience that got you, Jane Barber, interested in doing the work that you do?
Actually, yes, it was. Well, two things got me interested. First, Donna Stevens, the executive director of hospice, has been a dear friend for years. And in the early 2000s, she started describing this dream she had of bringing a peer support group, a family program for grief to Anchorage. And as she described it, I said, I want in. And that was due to a personal loss experience. 18 years ago, I lost my husband and four friends. And my son was five at the time. And we healed. And I knew, looking back, that especially for him, it was such an isolated thing. He was teased on the playground because his dad died. I took him to play therapist for a year, thank heavens, which worked really well for us because he was able to feel his feelings and move them. Very brave little boy. But I feel that what they get at Forget Me Not, what families get, is they get the opportunity to have all of that normalized. And I think that helps the whole body in being relaxed so that you can be in the process even if it isn't comfortable. There's that opportunity that when you're doing it alone, he felt abnormal. He didn't feel like he fit in. And so, yeah. So, yeah, it was personal that brought me forward to this.
I'm sorry to hear of your loss.
Oh, thank you.
Shirley, is it personal, the work that you do, the reason why you're involved with Forget Me Not?
I would say yes. I think it's because my mother died when I was a child, and it was a secret, and there were secrets. No one talked about it. And the magic of Forget Me Not is it's not a secret.
There's another program that's related to young people that Hospice of Anchorage is a part of or sponsors, and it's called Camp Erin. Jane, maybe you could tell us a little bit about Camp Erin and what it's all about.
Well, Camp Erin, it's Camp Erin Anchorage. We, Hospice of Anchorage, is in partnerships with the Moyer Foundation out of Seattle. Jamie Moyer, the baseball pitcher, and his wife started a foundation for children in distress in the early 2000s. And one of the elements of their foundation are Camp Erins, which are across the country. And we have a commitment with them to do them for 10 years. And it's once a year. It's an annual weekend grief camp for children ages 6 through 17. And basically, it's similar to the Forget Me Not. It's like a peer support group program. The difference is that you're in a traditional camp setting where the kids get to be outside with camp activities, traditional camp fun, and then we intersperse some grief activities in through the camp weekend. The activities are twofold, I would say. One would be to maybe help remember, memorialize, or work with their feelings and thoughts around the person that they lost to death. And the other is to resource in themselves and with their small community that they aren't alone, that what resources do I have inside of me and around me in my life to help me through this. And so it's kind of like a weekend intensive for kids, but it's wonderful.
And how can people in South Central get involved with that? How can they find out more if they need to sign up or get involved?
Yeah, they can just contact Hospice of Anchorage. Actually, I am kind of co-director for that program as well. And yeah, if they get in touch with me, we can visit about it and see if it sounds like a good fit for their family.
Well, I'd really like to thank both of you guys for your time today. It's been wonderful to learn about the programs that are offered in our community and also hear a little bit about how to support young people and ourselves when there's loss. Thanks again for coming, Shirley Valick-Wilson, and also Jane Barber. And they've been speaking with us today about the Forget Me Not Grief Program run by the Hospice of Anchorage. You're listening to Kids These Days on this listener-supported station. You can connect with us anytime by phone, toll-free, 888-KTD-RADIO. Those numbers are 888-583-7234, or leave a comment online at our website, kidsthesedays.org. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy, and you're tuned into Kids These Days, a weekly program where we talk about issues that affect the lives of young people in South Central Alaska and the community as a whole.
I am stretched on your grave, and I'll lie here forever. If your hands were in mine, I'd be sure they would not sever my apple tree, my brightness. It's time we were together, for I smell all the earth and I'm worn by the weather. When my family think that I'm safely in my bed, oh, from morn until night I am stretched out at your head, calling out unto the earth with tears hot and wild for the loss of the girl that I loved as a child. Do you remember the night, oh, the night the frost. Oh, and thanks be to Jesus, we did all that was right. And your maiden head still is your pillar of light.
And now, many Alaskans are people of faith, and in times of great emotional pain, spirituality can be of great comfort. One part of any religious leader's job is counseling, especially after a tragic event such as the death of a loved one. Our producer, Sarah Gonzalez, spoke with Pastor Julia Seymour of the Lutheran Church of Hope in Anchorage about how she helps children to cope with death from a faith perspective.
As a pastor, a spiritual leader, how do you initially reach out to children who are grieving?
Oftentimes, children are mostly overwhelmed and confused by the grieving that they see without totally understand what's going on. So I usually try to take a moment to be with a child, often a quiet space, you know, on the side of the living room and the side of the funeral home, and ask if they know what's going on, how they feel about it, what they think, you know, what's been said to them. And so that's usually where things start. Many times people try to protect their children from what they think may be overwhelming. And so children go and stay with a neighbor or stay with a friend, go stay with a less close family relative during a grieving time. And that can have its pros and cons.
How do you speak to parents then, and what do the parents need to know about what their child's going through?
Well, and that's most often where grief counseling for children starts, is parents come in and say, I don't know how to talk to my child about this. And one of the first things I would say you have to do as a parent is to sort out what you're thinking, what you're confused about, and what you're upset about from what might be the case for your child. So, if a child has had a sibling die, that's a very different thing than having had a grandparent die. And so you have to look at what the facts of the situation are, and also with regard to your faith tradition, what you believe has happened to that person. So it's one thing to have to talk with your child and say, you know, sometimes when people are very sick, their body stops working and they're dead. But we believe that after that happens, they're with God and they're happy and they're not feeling pain anymore. But you have to be very careful, because particularly young children can be very literal. So if you say things like, God took so-and-so to be with him so that she could be an angel, or so he could be an angel, that can be very frightening to a small child, because they will wonder, is God going to take me? Am I bad? Why didn't God take me? Why did God take so-and-so? Am I not good enough to be an angel? And so things that are comforting to you because of the circumstance and because you're able to understand metaphor is not the case for children until they're like 10 or 11. So you really have to be very clear with children beyond maybe what you're able to handle. But when you're dealing with grief with children, a little bit, you have to put your own feelings aside and talk with them about what they're seeing and what they're feeling, and be specific about the situation. Young children also tend to have a very strict cause and effect understanding of the world, and so something that might never occur to you can be magical thinking in your child's head. And so the fact that they, you know, rode a bike for the first time, and then shortly after grandma died, you would never correlate those things in your head. But to a child who has such a small time frame and perspective on the world, those things could be very closely correlated. And so when children are grieving, you need to watch for behaviors that they liked that they stopped doing, or new repetitive behaviors, and ask as gently as you can, well, what happened to riding your bike, or the thing that you were doing? Why aren't you doing that anymore? And just gently try to talk with them and tease it out. And you don't want to lead them, but there may be magical thinking can exist till 10 or 11 or 12, depending on the child's developmental abilities.
Children find comfort in what? In the knowledge of an afterlife, in the knowledge that they may be able to see this loved one again, or do they find comfort in an explanation? Where do you find that children, as a pastor, what comforts them?
I think children mostly find comfort in the fact that the people that they can still see still love them, that they can still do things that they did with the person who died, that it's okay to still talk about them or to think about them, and particularly that it's okay to be sad. And sometimes sadness can seem like something that, oh, I shouldn't be sad, you know, sad is bad, and it's not. And they may need the space to talk about what makes them sad or why they're sad, and it can be things that you never thought of. And to say, today I was thinking about, you know, Aunt Jo, remember how we used to go to the park with her? What do you think about when you think about her? I'm sad that we don't get to do that anymore. Are you ever sad when you think about her? And just try to keep it as casual as you can, but allow your child the space to say if they think about the loved one, if they think about the person. And it can take a while to process grief as a child. What seemed very temporary when they are 3 or 4, can suddenly sink in and be more permanent at 6 or 7, and they may ask questions about it again when you haven't thought of it for a long time.
This is a really heavy subject, death and loss and mourning and grief, and I think at the end of the road, what keeps people going often is a sense of hope, which is very important in faith. What do you do with hope? How does it figure in?
Well, we certainly, from my perspective, from the Christian perspective, we hope and expect and believe that we will see the people who have gone before us in faith. If that's what you believe in your family, it may help to talk about that in ways your children can understand. So your 5 or 6 or 7-year-old can have an idea of heaven. You can read some of those very last verses from the book of Revelation that talk about the tree of life and the river that flows beside it, and say, you know, this is where God tells us that grandma is now, and there's no crying and no night, and why don't we draw a picture of that? For other faith traditions that have an expectation of an afterlife, you will certainly talk about that as well with your child and do something similar. Go to your books or your documents of faith and explore what that looks like to you on your child's level. If your faith tradition or what you believe in general does not have an expectation of an afterlife, you don't want your children still to be afraid of death. And so you may talk with them about what it means to live a good life and to enjoy every day, and that people live on and what we remember of them. And so that may continue with recipes or family traditions that the deceased person started or was a heavy part of.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Sarah.
That's producer Sarah Gonzalez speaking with Pastor Julia Seymour of the Lutheran Church of Hope in Anchorage.
Take this soul.
We've heard from adults who work with and help kids through grief this hour. We're going to shift gears here a little and hear about someone's own personal experience. Caroline Willis is a student at the University of Alaska Anchorage working toward a degree in education. And while today she's all grown up, she was young when her mother died. She was just 18, a legal adult, but in many respects, still a kid. She wrote an essay about it for Kids These Days.
At 18, I lost my mother to cancer, a struggle not unlike others who have lost their parents to a disease. But this time, it was me who was directly affected by this death. Though I had lost both a friend and my grandmother within 2 years of my mother's passing, I had no coping skills, no way of expressing my complete and utter disapproval of her death. Disapproval, that was the only word that would come. Why did she have to leave? It happened really fast. She had gone from feeling a deep pain in her side to a diagnosis of terminal lung cancer in 4 short weeks. She passed just 3 days after we knew it was cancer. On the day she died, my steps were heavy, and my breath was strained. It hit me hard, and even though I knew the night she was going to pass, I could not bear with the reality that the most righteous woman I knew was going to die. So I dealt with it the only way I could. I kept the feelings to myself. The strongest emotion I remember having for my mother before she died wasn't sadness. It was teenage rage. She was always wanting to know where I was, what I was doing, and why I started wearing my hair so short. I didn't understand her constant and desperate need to know these things. Here I was, legally able to vote, an adult as far as the law was concerned. But that didn't matter to my mother, the expert stylist, who believed I was totally incapable of styling my own hair without looking like a punk. These teenage resentments were what I wrote about for the years following my mother's death. The grief I felt for her poured out silently through letters that started with, "Dear Mom." I have very few concrete memories of the year that followed her passing. Of those few, I remember the hot casserole a neighbor placed in my hands, a close friend giving me hugs just because, and a hospital nurse the day after my mother's death who told me it would be okay. I could not confide in my grieving family. They had their own pain to work through. So instead, I found comfort within myself and the enduring kindness of others. For years after her passing, I heard my mother's voice. And though I knew she was really not there, I felt comfort believing that she knew exactly where I was in my life. And yes, it has taken me years to talk about her, my love for her, and how her death influenced my life. And on most days, I'm happy. Now that I'm nearing 30, I have abandoned my teenage rage and remembered how to love my mother. I keep a picture of her on my desk. Behind her, the trees are green, and in the foreground, she leans barefoot into the back of a station wagon. The car is packed with clothes, a cooler, and an economy-sized box of Top Ramen. Her long brown hair is pulled back. She balances a cigarette between her pointer and middle finger. She's smiling. And when I look at it now, I smile too. The day of my mother's funeral, I remember my father telling me, "This too shall pass." I didn't want to hear that when I was 18, confused and filled with rage, but now I know it to be true. Even so, writing this essay you're hearing was a challenge. It's hard to find the words and arrange them in just the right way to say how I feel now and how I felt then when it happened and I was just a kid. But here it is, and I'm Caroline Willis.
That's it for Kids These Days this week. Thanks so much for joining us. The conversation doesn't stop here. You can join in anytime online at kidsthesedays.org. You can subscribe to a podcast of this program or listen to any of the stories you heard this hour. Read more about today's guests and link directly to the services we talked about today. Check out the calendar at kidsthesedays.org to find out what we're talking about next and where you can go to meet the Kids These Days or KTD team at community events. We had help today from Caroline Willis and Sarah Gonzalez. Sarah Gonzalez produced today's program and engineered for us in the studio. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and thanks again for joining us, and make sure you come again next week.
Ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.